I'm Jill Surgeson, a nurse midwife and researcher fascinated by the concept of trust and its role in our most meaningful relationships. Trust isn't just personal. It influences our health, our communities, and our institutions. In this podcast, we'll explore how trust manifests across different aspects of society, where it thrives, where it breaks down, and what we can do to build it. Through conversations with experts from a variety of disciplines, we'll examine how trustworthiness can lead to a more equitable and fulfilling world. Welcome to Trust Fund. I was a midwife for 20 years, and it was easy to see how trust between healthcare providers and patients could really impact someone's care. But why, as patients, do we sometimes just feel like we're another box to check for our healthcare provider? And what about all the providers, tired, overextended, who want to demonstrate more trustworthy behaviors and just don't know how? Today, we have the honor of learning from Dr. Neil Prose. Dr. Prose is professor of pediatrics, dermatology, and global health at Duke University, and the author of more than 100 pediatric dermatology publications and 2 pediatric dermatology textbooks. And Dr. Prose is an expert in empathic communication skills and teaches these techniques in medical centers around the U.S. He also developed national curriculum in doctor-patient communication for neurosurgery residents in the United States, and similar curricula in doctor-patient communication in medical schools and clinics in South Africa, Botswana, and Kenya. He helped to create a curriculum in respectful maternity care for midwives and health extension workers in Ethiopia, and for midwifery students in Chile and Patagonia. He is an inspiration to many, a mentor to me, and I am delighted to have had this opportunity to share his wisdom.
Dr. Prose, thank you so much for being with us here today.
Thank you for inviting me. It's really delightful.
I was conceptualizing this podcast, and I can honestly say I don't think anyone embodied more of the spirit of what I was trying to accomplish here in terms of trustworthy communication and commitment to trustworthy communication as you. And so it's a particular delight to have you here today. I wanted to start out, you shared with me before that you grew up in Brooklyn, and can you walk us through how this kid from Brooklyn found their way to pediatric dermatology, and then more radically than that, actually, I think, to your commitment to the study and teaching of compassionate communication in healthcare, and even your work in some birth trauma in sub-Saharan Africa?
Yeah. Well, I'll try to give you a short version of a long story, but I did grow up in Brooklyn, went to college at Swarthmore and medical school at NYU, and was drawn to pediatrics and to dermatology, and, you know, developed a career doing academic medicine and clinical care. And then, long story short, about 15, 20 years into all of that, discovered the thing I loved the most or cared about the most is the way we communicate and connect with patients and their families, and realize how many times, how often we struggle doing it well, and that there are specific skills that one can learn to do it a better job. And so that's when I began teaching communication skills to various health professionals in the United States, and eventually started to branch out to do work in low and middle income countries. And my wife is South African, so she convinced me to begin work in South Africa. I developed a course for, helped develop a course for medical students to communicate in the native language of isiZulu. And then more recently developed a course for midwifery students here in the south of Chile, where we are right now, and also in Ethiopia, a course in respectful maternity care. And that was a course that we developed a curriculum for midwives and health extension workers and how to communicate with women during childbirth in a way that's more empathetic than what may have been happening previously.
What were you seeing happening previously?
Well, it's a problem throughout the world, really, and maybe more severe in some low and middle income countries, that women, an entire problem that's been documented of women being neglected and abused during childbirth. And I was able to witness that firsthand by just being a fly on the wall on the obstetrics ward in Ethiopia, in a small city in Ethiopia, and then worked with collaborators from that country to talk about what words and actions and changes could occur to make the care more humanistic. And that was our project.
You know, one of the things that you've said to me before and that you've noted in some of your work is that, and obviously you've dedicated a lot of your career to addressing, is the lack, maybe not a malevolent lack or an intentional lack, but some of the lack about how to respectfully and compassionately communicate with patients in training programs such as medical school. And I always feel like, is that something that's sort of bred out of students over the course of their training? Because I do feel like people do go into these sort of benevolent fields many times with that at the forefront of their hearts. And then what we tend to see in practice can be something very different than that.
Well, I have two different kinds of thoughts. One is that you're absolutely right about the process of medical education. And there's studies to show that actually the degree of empathy decreases during medical school. And it's probably a variety of issues, including sort of maybe aspects of burnout or moral injury, but also just having role models that are modeling the opposite of what we want the students to learn. So they're starting to pick up on these bad habits instead of good habits. But also, I think it's more complex because the students who come in with this desire to be empathetic may not have the tools to express them. So the big problem to me with a lot of healthcare professionals is that we may experience empathy inside of us, but the tools for communicating it to patients are very specific and not always intuitive. And so if the students aren't equipped with the knowledge about what to say in different situations, then all of their efforts to be empathetic sort of end up being, can be very unsuccessful.
Well, I've had the pleasure of getting to be a guest lecturer in your class at least three times now, I think, at Duke.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit more about that class? Why it is a freshman seminar, which I always found fascinating and incredibly valuable, and what you have been able to accomplish or how you've seen that shape possible future clinicians at a really competitive school like Duke?
Well, I should explain, first of all, that it's a freshman seminar for undergraduates and not for medical students. So I've stepped into undergraduate education. And not all of the students, but many of them, but not all of them, are planning to be doctors. And some of them will change their mind during the course of college. But it occurred to me that the theme of the course, which is a global perspective on the experience of illness, is something that is useful for anyone because the essential tools of connection and empathy are something that we all need. And not only that, but I try to offer in the course a more global understanding of the issues the way in which we try to communicate with patients. But more than, in addition, the various social factors, including racism and immigration, that interfere with the communication and the provision of respectful healthcare.
You wrote an article that I love called "Some Words That Matter." And in this article, you describe a situation where you're asking some, I think they were dermatology physicians or residents, to list some of the things that they do to make patients feel more comfortable and cared for in their practice. I'm curious how that went and what kind of feedback you got from that exercise.
Oh, it's interesting. So the feedback I got, actually what's encouraging is the fact that people are healthcare providers, professionals are already doing a lot of the things that we hope they will be doing in communicating. But at the same time, it's just it's surprising or troubling how often folks just really don't know what to say. And my message to them is that the skills that that we use to communicate are very specific, and you can just learn to use them, and then you'll see that things, empathy can sometimes just fall into place. For example, I encourage every one of my learners, so to speak, to end every single encounter with a patient with, what questions do you have? That very specific sentence, because if you ask, do you have any questions, it has a different implication. But if you ask, what questions do you have, it gives the patient an opportunity to ask any question they were afraid to ask, and also participate in the decision to end the encounter, because they're voting with you that we're kind of done with what we need to do. So so in that respect, I think it's just a matter of these very specific things that one does. And when we talk about building trust in particular, I think that there are skills that are just critical to building trust and being trustworthy. One of them is just eye contact. It changes absolutely everything. If you're staring at a computer while you're talking to the patient, it's very hard for them to come to trust you. And just the decision to pay attention, because we're so distractible. So I advocate kind of taking a deep breath before even entering the room and making a conscious decision to pay attention in the presence of the patient.
I love that. When I was practicing as a midwife, I always tried to do that. And it takes less than a second. And I think it's a really remarkably centering activity. And even going into the room and taking a deep breath and just sort of taking in the energy of the room when you walk in. Mm-hmm.
And also being curious, because that's another fundamental of being trustworthy, is being curious. Really, the truth of the matter is, when you walk into the room for that first time, the only thing that informs your opinion of this new family that you're meeting, a new person you're meeting, are your biases or your prejudices that you can't avoid. And the way to get past those, the only way I know, is to be curious about the actual person with whom you're speaking. And that requires taking time to find out who they are. And then they become more interesting, and we become more caring, and they notice the difference. And I think that's a really important part of the process.
I love that. And in your paper that you wrote called Paying Attention, also another really lovely one, you talk about at the end of your visit, when you ask of them, is there anything else you want to tell me? And you said, I use that opportunity to relax and pay attention as I wait the answer, and that you're willing to do this several times. And what I love is that you wrote that in that way, and that you can relax with a patient and create that really safe space for them to be able to give you the information or ask the question that they want to ask. But my favorite thing is what you wrote next, is where you said, these two simple techniques consume little time in the course of a busy clinic schedule. Because I think what we hear a lot, and I've been guilty of doing it myself, is to say, I don't have time. I have so many patients waiting. And so I think your simple statement about how actually it doesn't take up that much time is a very helpful reminder of what our goals and priorities are in that room. And how do you respond to someone who says, you know, I'd love to be a better communicator with my patient. I'd love to sit there and talk to them all day, but I don't have time to do that. Our schedules are nuts. What is your response to that as someone who still practices?
Right. Well, actually, what you said, a lot of the things that we advocate, you and I both, are not very time consuming. They actually may save time, because if the patient is still feeling not listened to, they may repeat the same question over and over again, and you may make very little progress in communicating. So I think that the issue of time is often, it feels that way, that there's no time for this, or it may feel to some people that it's too emotionally draining to connect with families, that we, but of course we both agree the opposite is true, that the emotional sustenance for us as professionals comes from making those connections, not from avoiding. Yeah. But I have to add one more thing, because I don't want to completely dismiss the issue of time. I think that we're all being pressured to see more patients in a shorter period of time because healthcare has become such a business. And we need to, at some point, we need to also resist that. So we can't just say, well, we can do anything in 2 minutes, because it's not true. And to the extent that we're being pushed into providing faster care in ways that aren't appropriate, we need to try any way we can to put a stop to that. So that's the best to be realistic about the opening.
I had a really interesting conversation with a woman who is in charge of developing some AI interventions for big health systems. And she was talking about the use of kind of this AI assistant in visits, where you basically have an AI scribe that will do kind of AI automatic charting for you, so the healthcare provider can ostensibly pay more attention to the patient. My thought of that is sort of what you said earlier, which is that's great if you have the skills in which to draw from. Cheap that. What are you thinking about AI in the exam room? Have you had that experience yet?
I haven't done it. I have to say that I have very mixed feelings about it, because I'm just, to the extent that we want this to be a trustworthy private conversation, to if I were to explain at the beginning of every visit that there's an AI thing somewhere who's listening to everything we say, I can imagine it's a reasonable response to think, well, that doesn't feel comfortable or safe, but the patient may not feel empowered to say that. And so they're kind of going along with something that makes them even less trusting than they would be otherwise. So that to me is one of the issues. There's also a whole kind of notion, a growing notion out there, that AI can be more empathetic than we can, because they can just kind of use all these, it can create all of these kind of, and it's been, sadly, it's been studied that the responses, AI-generated responses to patients' questions online have been generally not only more accurate, but more empathetic than doctors' responses to, you know, in real life. But I think that's not an argument for using AI, and that's an argument for getting better at this, so we can do at least as well as the computer in connecting and listening to patients and their families.
How do you think that physicians especially could best integrate these lessons of compassionate, respectful communication that ultimately generate trustworthy behaviors into their education?
I think the education just has to be a continuous, let me put it this way, half of the work of being a healthcare professional is communication. The other half is sort of the knowledge, find it and fix it part. So if you imagine that, and then you realize that 99% of the education is about only half of the work, in, say, in medical school, you can see what the problem is. So in fact, as a general principle in the United States, the first year or two of medical school has to have some component of teaching communication skills. And sometimes it's done really well and sometimes not as well. And then after that, you're on your own. And very often you have no further education for the rest of your life. So if you imagine sort of this, it has to be a part of lifelong learning. You have to have even opportunities to watch your own influencers on video and critique them. Without any more training, you're going to get worse instead of better. So I think it's just, it's where we put the emphasis, but it's not, frankly, it's not, It may not be, health systems may not appreciate the value of doing this, even if they don't appreciate the value of many other things that they're there, that we need to be doing that are more generating of, a profit. So what's one of the obstacles that we're kind of up against?
It's true. You don't see a lot of like CME credits for learning how to do these things.
No, you don't. You don't see nearly as much as there should be.
Mm-hmm. And how do you feel? Are there any anecdotes? Like, what have you come? Well, first of all, how many years have you practiced?
35. Or 40, something like that.
I imagine that your relationship with the concept of trustworthiness, you said several years into your practice, you realized that these human actions were part of your pay. And that's how I always felt. It felt like just such an extraordinary honor to be immediately privy to someone's most personal life in some way, to be able to lay hands on their children or their babies or whatever, their pregnant bellies. How has that trajectory changed for you? What qualities of trustworthiness have you found that have served you best? How are you hoping to still grow in your practice in this way?
I think part of it, just to be honest, is much easier with experience, because I don't have to spend so much time worrying about diagnosis and treatment. I kind of know a lot of stuff already. And so it gives me this luxury of focusing on the more kind of human connection part, and not on worrying about what am I going to do next or what am I going to prescribe. So that's something you can't short circuit that. So for younger professionals, it's more difficult because they're more anxious about their own ability to do the work. Mm-hmm. So that's part of it. The other thing I want to mention with respect to trustworthiness is I think it requires, it requires a really specific knowledge of things like history and society. And the example I use frequently is the process of building trust in a discordant relationship where the healthcare professional is white and the patient may be Hispanic or African American. And we can go into that room thinking that everybody's equal and it doesn't matter and I'm colorblind, but it doesn't work that way. And there's a couple of reasons why it's more complicated. One is because I'm aware of my own biases that are kind of affecting the way I might care for a patient. But even more so, I have to be aware of that the process of building trust is more complicated. You can't just assume that people are going to trust you from the moment they meet you just because you're a doctor. And especially if they have their own personal or family history of mistreatment.
Yeah.
And so you have to be aware of that, even if it's not out and if it's not spoken, it's in the room. And if you don't take that seriously, it's a big problem because you just kind of, I talk about being on the same side of the table with the patient, looking at the problem together. It's not going to happen if you haven't recognized those historic realities. Mm-hmm. And if a patient were to say, I do an exercise with the students where the standardized patient, the actor, says something like, if my skin were white, if I weren't Hispanic, you would be treating me differently. And often the learners it's like a deer in headlights. They don't know what to say, and they just immediately say, "No, we don't discriminate here." It doesn't work. And the only response I found that I can actually suggest to people is to say simply that I understand why you feel that way. That there is a history of being treated badly, and we're going to try our best to do differently. If you don't unite around the concept that it's a problem with the patient, there's no way, it's very hard to build trust going into the future. And that's something that's really hard for us to get and remember. But I have a constant awareness of that when I'm caring for patients.
I think it goes back to your earlier statements about curiosity And in this, it's curiosity about the human, but it's really just curiosity about the whole context of that and of their humanness and their human experience. And one of my favorite definitions of trust in healthcare is basically the ability to believe that someone else has your best interest at heart in the presence of a situation of unequal vulnerability. When I was doing some research early on in my doctoral work about trusting and trustworthiness, there were hundreds and hundreds of papers about why patients don't trust. They don't trust this, they don't trust that. And I think only a handful about being a trustworthy a clinician who practices trustworthy behaviors, and some of those are your papers. And so there is definitely this behavior often where we put the most vulnerable half of this dyad, which would be the patients, in the most delicate position here. We put the burden of trust on them, where the burden of trust should really be on the most powerful half of that dyad, the least vulnerable, which would be the healthcare provider. And when I talk about this, I often say it's because we know as healthcare providers what we come into the room with, but we have no idea what those patients come into the room with. And to put the burden of trust on them just because we're at a fancy hospital or an elite academic institution or we have a certain degree behind our names is really cheating everyone out of the experience of building a relationship, a care relationship, and best serving that patient, I think.
Well, you put that beautifully. I never thought about this notion of where we place the burden of trust, but it's exactly what I'm aiming for. Because we can't presume the patient should trust us. It doesn't even make sense from any logical point of view, given the way things tend to work. And we can't negate the power difference. It's huge, and we have to be with that. And I think there are ways. I also think there are ways that you can sort of level the playing field by just the way you show interest in the other person. So, for example, when I see patients who are immigrants from either Mexico or Central America, I always sort of start by talking about that, and I'll say, like, you know, so I'm lucky that I speak Spanish, but in any case, I starting from, like, from where are you from, and then acknowledging that life has been very difficult in those countries, and is your family still there, and acknowledging that it must be hard, and that is just a couple of minutes. There's sometimes magical. Because all of a sudden, and you think about immigrants and trust, you know, it's terrifying to not speak the language, to be kind of worried about deportation nowadays, and to have just the very process of taking an interest in the person and their lives before they became immigrants, which were really still very important to them, is so enormous. How long did that take me? Like 35, 40 seconds, 1 minute. And what a difference it makes. So this, it's just this. And then I'm at the end of the day, I've learned something about somebody who comes from a place that I may have visited, I may not have visited. They may be very beautiful. They may be very dangerous. And I'm better off for it. I've had a better day than I would have had otherwise.
You've hit on something that I used to respond to very cheekily, but honestly, when someone said to me, like a student would say, what could I do to become a better student? I would always say, learn Spanish. Or basically, because we're working with about a 98% Central American population. So even knowing how to say, I don't speak Arabic, for example, but I do know how to say basic greetings and things. And by speaking the language, even just a few words, it shows an effort to see them, unique individuals.
It's such an anonymous experience to be in living in somebody else's country. And you're just constantly aware that nobody knows who I am. Nobody values what I was before. nobody imagines what I've gone through. And it's hard. That's just the kind of isolation that is just relentless. And you don't want to have that isolation with your healthcare provider. You want to have something very different.
I want to switch gears a little bit here because you and your wife made a beautiful, beautiful short documentary several years ago. And I was wondering if you could say a little bit about Keepers of the House and what you learned about trust through that process and respect and interprofessional collaboration. It's just lovely.
Thank you so much. Yeah, well, the film began in a conversation I had with a colleague about the way that hospital housekeepers, cleaners provide emotional support for patients and their families, and how we don't recognize the work that they do. And so we started out with the notion of doing a study or a focus group. But as we moved into the questions and answers, we realized how rich those stories are. And but as you mentioned, my wife Rhonda Klebanski is a documentary filmmaker, and so we created this 15-minute documentary, Keepers of the House. And Keepers of the House is a series of short interviews with hospital cleaners, both in English and in Spanish, where they talk about the amazing things they do in terms of providing emotional support, in terms of singing, providing food, getting encouragement, and also the trauma they go through when a patient dies, who they've gotten to know very, very well, and then nobody tells them what happened. So all these different issues kind of unfolded in the course of making the film. And the thing I learned subsequently through speaking with a couple of different researchers, a woman named Nicole Vance and a woman named Jane Dutton, is that in many ways, the extent to which the cleaners feel valued or devalued in their work depends on the daily interactions that they have with us. And so if we ignore them, if we don't greet them by name, if we neglect to get out of the way and they're trying to move a cart down the hall, those are all things that have an impact. And it's very, most of us don't recognize what the housekeepers are doing every day, how they're connecting with patients. And so that was the purpose of the film, is to bring that that to people's attention. And fortunately, the film has, had a fair amount of traction, being shown in a variety of medical schools and healthcare settings. And so we're hopeful that it's actually having some impact in that, with respect to that whole issue.
I love this idea that film illustrates, which is that feelings of trust and trustworthiness they're accessible to all of us. And part of that happens, we talk a lot about between care providers and patients. But what I saw in that film was spectacular, which was that patients, often terminally ill, would tell the housekeepers that they had grown close to aspects of their lives that they wouldn't tell anyone else. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are about that trust bond that was really unique, really beautiful. And like you said, went both ways. It went to the employees as well, which largely explained their devastation at not knowing some of the outcomes of these patients.
I think it's just, if we look at in the film and the behaviors that the housekeepers describe, it's all about listening and paying attention. That's what they're doing. That's what we sometimes neglect to do. So you can see where those, you can sort of see from the stories what those skills are. And the other thing that strikes me is that very often the cleaners are in a much more, are living in the same world as the patients socioeconomically. And so they're almost acting as what we would call cultural brokers, because they get it. They know what the patients may be up against. And so that's something we can't, we don't have access to that, to that life experience. Most of us don't. And the housekeepers do. So in many ways, it's natural that they can, they're able to forge bonds that we're just not always able to create.
I was part of an institutional effort for a large health system not too long ago that was looking at how, as a health system, they could build slash restore trust in the community. And one of the big complaints that came from the community and a lot of these listening groups was that they found a faltering of trust in the health system because of the valet system. And it had nothing to do with the valet. It had to do with the cost of parking and how inaccessible that was. And an hourly rate could be more than their hourly pay. And so I think we've talked a lot about interpersonal trust, but when I think about institutional trust in healthcare, your film illustrates this well. That's project illustrated this well, is that there's no one that a patient interacts with in their experience of healthcare who does not inform their feelings of either being more vulnerable or less vulnerable, which I alluded to earlier as being sort of the one of the key kind of conceptual definitions of trusting and or not trusting. So I love what your movie contributed in emphasizing that this is not a quality that is simply the purview of just healthcare providers and patients.
Not in the least. It's everybody, like you said, everybody from the front desk to the, you know, whoever works in the health system. But I'll tell you something else, Jill. It's also the system itself, because if you've just been told that your insurance is not going to pay for this procedure that you need, or you owe the hospital X amount of money and they're going to, they want to be paid by, you know, as quickly as possible, that erodes trust enormously. And so, and that's something that is individual professionals, we don't have much control over. So it's both a system, it's a systems thing, it's an individual thing, it's the entire experience from beginning to end.
Yeah. Before we go, I'm going to ask you if you have any last thoughts, but I also want to offer up a quote of yours that is so wonderful. And I think it really embodies what we've talked about today. And I felt this way on my very best days of practicing, which were most days. You said that your practice of exhibiting trustworthy qualities had greatly enhanced, you know, many things in your practice. You said, but I was not prepared for the ways in which caring for patients would become more interesting and enjoyable. I am more appreciative of my patients' special strengths and less judgmental about the ways they hadn't measured up to what I might have expected. That's beautiful.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, that's really true. And it speaks to the fact that when, for example, the patients don't adhere to our treatments, we immediately blame them. For example, that any notion of why they couldn't afford it, why it didn't make sense to them, you know, there's so many different possibilities there. And we just, you know, patients get labeled as quote unquote difficult. And you know all about that. I'm sure you've seen that as well, Joe. And you have to just, you have to investigate that. You have to say, have a conversation and try to figure out what that thing is, because people are frightened, they're vulnerable, they're terrified, they're angry, but it doesn't make them difficult people. They're in a difficult situation.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that. Thank you. Thank you for reminding me of that quote, Christy. Yeah.
Before we close today, and thank you so much, do you have any other pearls, advice, aspirations that you would like to share about your journey through exploring what it means to
really see the person in front of you?
Gosh, I think we just covered so much already. I just want to thank you for doing this podcast and for raising the issue as an issue of trustworthiness, because I think it really is. And I think maybe I need to myself and be incorporating that concept into the way that I educate medical students and college students, and to think about that and what you call the burden of trustworthiness. I think that's a huge kind of revelation for me. So thank you so much.
Well, that's high praise. Thank you. And I will put a link to your movie in the website as well, so people can go and take a look at it there.
Thank you so much, Dr. Prose. Have a lovely time in Chile.
Thank you.
Such an honor.
Bye-bye. Yeah, thank you so much for thinking of me.
Hey, before you go, here's a shameless plea. If you like this episode, hit that subscribe button wherever you listen to your podcast. That way you'll never miss a new episode. You can also find more about us at trustfundpodcast.com and follow us on Instagram and LinkedIn. If you loved what you heard, I trust you to leave a 5-star rating. It really helps others find the show. Trust Fund is a production of Jill Surgeson and the Duke University School of Nursing.